talked about Zaratas tonight. And before I see what questions you have, or this is a chance for you to ask them anyway, I want to make some points again that I made last time, because I fully realize that Nietzsche is not the easiest reading, and is perhaps a different kind of discourse than the kind of discourse that you're all familiar with. So I want to make again, say again what I said last time, that in one sense Nietzsche is above all a poet and not a systematic thinker, so that you can't really read him as a systematic thinker. You can't ask your favorite question, question I'm sure you ask, why doesn't that square? Or why does he contradict himself? Because all great prophets of religion and all poets realize that life is contradiction. In other words, Nietzsche really goes to the two things that perhaps some of you find most difficult to accept. One is that life is contradictions. And the other thing is that these contradictions do not go away. That the only way to deal with them is to transcend them, to accept them. Just as I'm quite sure you find it very difficult at your age to realize that there are insoluble problems, which you think every problem can be solved. If I looked into the hearts before me, I'd rather not, I think, but never mind, I would find on the whole that they were full of hope that things would be solved. Well, that's of course nonsense. Most problems are totally unsolvable and will never be solved, you realize. So Nietzsche, in a way, leads up to that, that there are problems that will never be solved. Never, never. And that the only way to solve these problems in the modern world is through accepting the existential situation. And Nietzsche describes the existential situation through paradoxes, on the one hand, and on the other hand, through the way to deal with it, the acceptance through power of will and through a certain harmony within yourself, through the Apollinian and Dionysian ideas. And therefore, the Apollinian, which may be most difficult for you to understand, is very well comprised in that saying that I tried to make clear to you last time, that the value of a human being does not consist in his usefulness, for he would continue to exist even if there were nobody to whom he could be useful. What Nietzsche therefore says, you must look into yourself, understand yourself, make your own value, come to your own terms with the chaos of life, and therefore, through your own power of will, transcend it. And once he's made this statement, then obviously all manners and morals and everything else you can think of is slavery, is Christianity, is slavery. And that the only way to live is by this power of will, by affirming in a way your individuality, but not without context. Because the other thing about Nietzsche that I try to make clear is that he makes no distinction between the outward and the inward world. In a sense, let me put it this way, you receive the outward world into your inward world. The Dionysian means, in a way, receiving, accepting. The English language is a very bad language, if you don't know. For anything at all ideological, it isn't suitable, because only the German languages, because Romanticism in England went differently and not so theoretical, so the English language is a singularly untheoretical language. And there are many things that are very difficult to express in English, but which in German are very simple to express in these regards, because all this links to German idealistic philosophy in terminology. So that the best way I can put it in English is that the outward world is received within you, assimilated by you, and then you throw yourself back into the life force. So it is reified by you, to use a technical word, it is received by you, and you throw yourself into it then, after it is received by you. And that is why Nietzsche always makes that point, that there is no difference between the real and the apparent world. There's only one world. There is no real world, there is no apparent world, there's only your will. There's only your will and your individuality. And there is only together with that what he called the life force. He was a Darwinian. He thought that life was sort of a force into which you threw yourself, a kind of speed trip, if you like, to use your vocabulary. A kind of a speed trip, yeah? Into which you throw yourself. Because, of course, Nietzsche accepted all these things, the speed, the fact that all impressions are sense impressions, all the kind of things that the positivists didn't like when Nordau said, what are we going to do? Every impression is fleeting. For Nietzsche, everything was dynamic, and indeed, every expression is fleeting. So his ideal type, as I said last time, is on the one hand the Old Testament patriarchs, who he quite rightly saw slept around, lied their bloody heads off. They did, to read the Bible. Abraham told one lie after another, usually about his sex life. They lied, they wenched, they lived. So, the patriarchs, not the patriarchs of your Sunday school, they are bourgeois patriarchs. Nietzsche's patriarchs were taken out of their bourgeois context. And the second one, of course, the barbarians, who did much the same. Yes? So these were obvious. And these figures were, for him, masculine figures. Because we always come back that all of this is really tied up with a longing for virility. Now, you can say this is part of Nietzsche's life. But Nietzsche's girlfriend was one of the most remarkable women of the 19th century. There were several kinds of women around who were the girlfriends of every famous man. There are two in history. One is this, Lou Andrea Salome, a very hysterical Russian. Indeed. Who was the girlfriend of Nietzsche, of Freud, of practically every novelist of note. But other than what Nietzsche said, she rejected Nietzsche in the end. And that may have had something to do with his attitude towards women in general. Because she rejected him. And she was a girlfriend who else? There's Nietzsche, and there's Freud, and there are two or three other famous people whose girlfriend she was. And the second one is, of course, much more recent, is Alma Balfour, who was the wife of the composer Mahler, the wife of Werfel, and another girlfriend of Sigmund Freud. There were these two ladies who really, as it were, you know, combined sex and genius. So, what you have therefore here in Nietzsche, however it might be, you have, of course, the rejection by Lou Andrea Salome, which is quite right, and this may have done it. But it is built into his thought, of course, this idea of virility. What is also clear about Nietzsche, and I must stress, is that, of course, he had no use for nationalism. That's important because I'll have to talk in a little while on the taming of Nietzsche. But Nietzsche was supernatural, national. Nationalism was to him another wall which people built around themselves. And he was full of contempt, of course, for his fellow Germans. Full of contempt for them, full of contempt for nationalism, which was for him part of the kind of bourgeois walls which were built around. And indeed, I think we must say in a summary way that as far as Nietzsche is concerned, nothing that was part of a consensus was in any way good, but everything was bad. And so again and again you will find it not only in vain against nationalism, Germans, workers, manners and morals, come back to the workers in a minute, manners and morals, but also against things that people like. Happiness. Happiness, he said, is a soothing medicine. Happiness is opposed to mastery. So all the virtues, all these things, they are to be overcome and transcended, and that includes not only nationalism, manners, and morals, but also happiness. Now there are two critiques, however, that I want to say something more about. One which becomes very important is this critique of the bourgeoisie, that the bourgeoisie is in fact nothing else but equivocation, that it is compromise, consensus, and equivocation. And as it puts it on page 368 of your reading, as follows, I'm sorry, at 357, of your reading as follows, you know, here, he says the bourgeoisie is a hodgepodge, and not only the bourgeoisie, but the mob, the crowd, the people. Mob, however, means hodgepodge, mob hodgepodge, you read, and there everything is mixed up in every way, saint and scamp, Junker and Jew, and every kind of beast out of Noah's Ark. And then he goes on to attack good manners. Everything among us is false and foul. Now what Nietzsche is doing here, he is attacking the mob and the bourgeoisie for the same reason, the lack of decisiveness, the consensus, the trying to reconcile equals. Now why is that so unequal? Why is it so bad to reconcile the Junker, who is the Prussian nobility, and the Jew? Why shouldn't they be reconciled? Because that is, of course, part of a consensus. That is the opposite of what the Superman does. He accepts inequality. And therefore, Nietzsche has a remarkable passage. In fact, he is in fact not anti-Semitic, but highly philo-Semitic, because he identifies Jews with these patriarchs. He believes, therefore, that these opposites must be accepted. And the mob is similar to him, an undifferentiated mass. This is an attack on consensus and compromise. Now that will become very important, because within its paradoxes, there's always the idea that you must accept opposites. Love and hate, we went over it last time. And that means two things, which are very important. Decisiveness. And the second thing it means is clear decisions. And in literary way, it means search for clear forms. Now, when I come to the taming of Nietzsche, and I want to say that now, this becomes very important. Because poets like Ezra Pound or Yeats, for example, what they feared above all, as Ezra Pound put it, that life was a formless wobble. What are we going to do, says Ezra Pound, with life as a formless wobble? And so a whole generation of writers was drawn to Nietzsche, including Ezra Pound, because of the clear decisions. And clear decisions for these people meant clear literary form. And clear literary form mean classical form. For Pound and for Yeats and for all of them, it meant classical form. So that in the end, through this clear decision, as far as this problem of the artist's relation to life is concerned, the fear of the poet that life is a formless wobble, and what do you do with a formless wobble? That this kind of fear in the end becomes a longing for classical form. And in this way it becomes tame. And in this way, of course, is the ultimate reason why Ezra Pound and Yeats and the greatest poets of the 20th century became fascists. Because fascists to them in the end came to stand for clear literary forms, for classical and clear literary forms. But everywhere, Nietzsche encouraged decisiveness. And decisiveness will be the hallmark of all conservatives. No compromise, no formless wobble, no mob, and no bourgeoisie, but instead clear forms, decisive. Now obvious. Within this decisiveness, the Superman moves. And how does the Superman move? And here we come to one part of Nietzsche I haven't mentioned yet. But Nietzsche, through Schopenhauer, was very much influenced by Eastern thought in this regard. And so Nietzsche believed that life is destined to return. And this is, of course, part of Greek mythology as well, that life returns again and again. In Zarathustra, you will find this line repeated very often, that life as you have lived it, you will have to live again uncountless times. Now, this idea that life you have to live uncountless times, that death isn't really death, but after death you relive your life, is both Greek mythology, and it's very strong in Schopenhauer because it's called karma, as you know, in Indian Buddhism, and in these religions it's called karma, the eternal return. Now that doesn't mean, my dear, that you're reborn into a duck soul. That can also happen to you. But this is, you have to live your life over and over again, yes? Over and over. Now, for Nietzsche, that was undoubtedly an agonizing thought. An agonizing thought, no doubt. A thought of suffering, a crushing. And many people believe that it is out of this realization that you have to live your life over and over again, and there is no escape. After all, in Christianity, there's escape. You go to heaven and you go to hell. But whether you fry below or you sing hymns above, it ain't the same as in Madison, Wisconsin, no? You agree with that, yes? Well, hell, maybe you didn't like it. But anyway, it isn't the same as Madison, Wisconsin, is it? But if you have to relive your life again and again, that is not yet a horrible thought for you, I'm sure. You think, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. But for somebody of my age, that's a pretty awful thought. So, that I can sympathize, it's an agonizing thought. And out of this thought, it may help you, it is thought that Nietzsche believed you must accept life. If you have to repeat it constantly, then you must accept the contradiction. Then you must throw yourself into life. Because otherwise, this idea of Greek mythology and of Buddhism would be to Nietzsche, who didn't believe in God, God is dead, unbearable. The apotheosis, the climax, which for Christian comes after life, really, in proper theology. After life, for Nietzsche had to come in life. And so the apotheosis is the acceptance of life. Being a Superman, throwing yourself into life, enjoying it. Reality is the true life. God, after all, is dead. Now the Superman, if we look at him for a minute, is he really a genius? Yes and no. How does he come about? The Superman comes about by accident. By accident. He can't obviously be educated, yes? The kind of endeavor I am engaged in with you is a completely un-Nietzschean endeavor. Because for Nietzsche education, you know, he has to say the most harsh words about it. Educating you is to teach you to be slaves. Superman obviously doesn't come about by education. How does he come about? As he said, great men are like great tides, explosive substances. They call fate into the world. So, the great man suddenly explodes from the world. Somehow, he is born in a thunderstorm, an odd reference to Germanic legends. The Nazis, the racists, will believe that the Aryan is born in a thunderstorm. and the great German literature about Aryan youth, you know, climbing out of thunderstorms in the news and all of that. So it's a very odd reference to the birth of the Aryan. But he didn't mean it, of course, like that, that the Aryan is born from a thunderstorm. But rather he meant it that great men have to come about like that. Because obviously anything else would weaken their will, would make them slaves. They must come out from outside, as it were. And of course, it won't surprise you that the great man is an end in himself. End in himself. That is the same quotation. I will get to the will to power. The will to power is the origin of creativity. Creativity does not mean creating myths. It doesn't mean creating myths. It, of course, means be yourself or the thing that I've talked about. Indeed, perhaps it will help you still more if you look again at the last scene of Wedekind, which you will have want to restudy for the 6 weeks anyway. At the end, the masked man who comes to Moritz, and Moritz says to the masked man, "Oh, my parents drove me to it." Yes? Remember that. He says, "My parents drove me to it." And the masked man said, "What nonsense. Your parents had nothing to do with it. What is important is the shall and will." And that is a kind of Nietzschean ending to Wedekind. The parents had nothing to do with it. If you commit suicide, it was your own shall and will. Your will was too weak. Your will was too weak. That was it. So you have that ending as well. Now the Superman is obviously contemptuous for the mob. And to those of you who like both Marx and Nietzsche by any chance, I want you to read what Nietzsche has to say, what should be done with the working class. I rather like it myself, you won't. Find it. What Nietzsche has to say about the working classes is this. The working classes, he says, should leave Europe. They should go away. They should, it's page 91 actually, the reference of your portable if you're interested in reading it. The workers in Europe should declare henceforth that as a class they are a human impossibility. That's the suggestion many of us had about America in the Vietnam War. The Americans just should declare we have won and leave it, yes. That's the best idea. They should do it right now, you know, against the Russians as well. Anyhow, the workers in Europe should declare henceforth that as a class they are human impossibility, and not only, as is customary, a harsh and purposeless establishment. They should introduce an era of vast swarming out from Europe, the like of which has never been experienced, and with this act of emigration in the grand manner, protest against the machine, against capital, against the choice with which they are now threatened, of becoming of necessity either slaves of the state or slaves of a revolutionary party. Nietzsche's solution to the European workers' problem is to send them to America. So, well, that's what happens, isn't it? So, that on the whole, that's his solution. But there you see again, you class has no meaning for him, revolution has no meaning for him, the mob is undifferentiated. The proletariat should simply declare itself as an end. Indeed, Nietzsche also has a very remarkable passage about imperialism. For again, in this kind of odd idea, he does become contradictory. For Nietzsche shares, typically enough, with Germans one thing all Germans share: a prejudice against the Slavs, the Russians especially, which, as many of you know, had a lot to do with the outbreak of the First World War, which was a German preventive war against Russia, basically. So Nietzsche suddenly has this outburst where he fastens his whole ideas, which have nothing to do with the state, to imperialism. I mean, such an increase in the threatening attitude of Russia that Europe would have to make up its mind to become equally threatening. namely to acquire one will by means of a new caste to rule over the continent, a persistent, dreadful will of its own that can set its aims thousands of years ahead, so that the long-spun-out comedy of its petty statism, its dynastic as well as its democratic, and notice this, willy-nilliness, the democratic, formless wobble, might finally be brought to a close. The time for petty politics is past. The next century will bring the struggle for the domination of the world, the compulsion to great politics. Now, that, of course, doesn't make sense at all, but it's a kind of interesting passage, because not even Nietzsche could stand apart from the German fear of Russia, from the idea of a politics of domination. And it is, of course, this passage, which later on was quoted and re-quoted from the Nazis to others, to underline the application of Nietzsche to a politics of power, to a great politics, to the application which otherwise he never made at all. He never made at all. But this kind of passage, I think, you should know about. Perhaps we can... That passage, yes, I can tell you exactly if I can find it again. It's not in your portable, unfortunately. It is in a Everyman volume called The Philosophy of Nietzsche, on page 130, but it is in, actually, in Beyond Good and Evil, but unfortunately not an excerpt, as I think that is in your, that is in, it's passage 2A, Beyond Good and Evil, goes by paragraph, and I don't think that's in your portable, but I must complete, it isn't. It's passage 208, or paragraph 208, in Beyond Good and Evil, yeah? That you have this remarkable offer which contradicts everything. Because in the last resort, obviously, Nietzsche believes that there is no objectivity, that there is no such thing of objective man. And again, that's something really not in your portable at all, but again omitted, unfortunately, from Beyond Good and Evil in your portable, but yet a remarkable passage against objective man, with which I want to sum up what I have to say and see if you have any questions now about Nietzsche, what you pose. The objective man, who no longer curses and scolds like the pessimist, the ideal man of learning, in whom the scientific instinct blossoms forth fully after a thousand complete and partial failures, is assuredly one of the most costly instruments that exists. But his place is in the hand of one who is more powerful. He is only an instrument. We may say he is a mirror, but no purpose in himself. The objective man is in truth a mirror, accustomed to prostration before everything that wants to be known, with such desires only as knowing or reflecting. He waits until something comes, and then expands himself, so that even the light footsteps and gliding path of spiritual beings may not be lost on the surface and filled. Whatever personality he still possesses seems to him accidental, arbitrary, or still often disturbing. So here you have, in a way, a summary. The objective man, whether he is the learned man, the man of any education, the bourgeois, lacks purpose, lacks thinking of himself as a thing in itself. He only reflects, and he is therefore on a level with women. In fact, on a level with all of those who don't model themselves on the patriarch or the barbarian. Finally, of course, there's in Nietzsche something else. The superman is not as individual as one thinks, because Nietzsche talks about a race of supermen. But when he talks about a race of supermen, he doesn't mean an elite, as we think of an elite, but separate individuals who all act accepting life, but they may act accepting life in quite different ways. In other words, the race of Superman was later interpreted as a racial elite, or a political elite, or some kind of elite of Superman. But for Nietzsche and his concept, there can really be no elite in the, let us say, the Greek sense, or the common sense that we use the term. So there is a race of Superman. By the very nature of the Superman, they cannot pull together. They must pull apart, because everyone accepts life, you see. And there can therefore not be, as it were, a kind of elite. Later on, and when I now come to the taming, to be sure, aviators, mountain climbers, all this kind of thing was looked upon as a new elite of Superman, because they were daring, yes? And after all, the fascist elite, the totalitarian elite, any elite will model themselves in the end on three elites in modern times. You mustn't forget that. There are only three elites in modern times on which modern elites, in a way, model themselves. One is the elite of the stormtrooper in the First World War, the people who jumped over the trench, who led the thing over the trench to almost their certain end. The stormtroopers in the Civil War, the second is the mountain climber, and the third is the aviator, of which the myth of the aviator we talk about becomes the strongest myth of an elite. But these are not Nietzsche's elites. These are elites which are connected with daring. These are elites which are connected with willpower. I suppose you have to have a willpower if you climb a mountain, or if you're an early aviator, you know, these were in 747. If you're an early aviator, or if you're a mountain climber. And so you get a very un-Nietzschean way. These myths, the myth of the stormtrooper, the mystique of the mountain climber, and the mountain films between the wars, very popular all over Europe, and then you get the mystique of the aviator. That's still with us, of course, and we shall talk about it. But these aren't Nietzschean Supermen. These are the Supermen tamed, because they are Supermen only in the fact that they have courage, and that they pride themselves on their virility. No women pilots, no women mountain climbers, by the way, and of course no women stormtroopers. And it's very typical that pilots is the last sort of profession that's become open to women. And you still don't think of women mountain climbers, ever. There are no famous women mountain climbers. The Matterhorn, the Swiss mountains, weren't first climbed by women, no? So, then again, it goes together with virility. Together with virility, the modern idea, this idea of elite. But that is already to what I want to come to now, next. Which is the taming of Nietzsche. Because it must be clear to you, that it isn't clear to you. I never know what's clear to you or not. Nothing of this may be told me. Never mind. Yes, do mind. The question is, nothing may be clear to you, but you can't be a Nietzsche. Just not possible to be a Superman or Supergirl. That there is a nostalgia for that is clear. But if you analyze, as I once did, Superman on television, yeah, he's not Nietzschean either. Because Superman is typical for the taming of Nietzsche. Well, you all know Superman, so I'll take him as an example. You should be interested in this sort of thing. Superman is daring. Yeah. He's courageous. He's homoerotic, yes. He has camaraderie, but he's also filled with bourgeois virtues, yes? He's a little do-gooder, you know? He does good. You know, he's chaste, or he's made out to be chaste, yes? And he is strong because he has these virtues. So one thing I want you to learn at the beginning, that the taming of Nietzsche turns him on his head. The new elites, aviators, mountaineers, yeah, stormtroopers in the war, Superman. They are virile because they are virile. Yeah. If Superman slept around, he would be caught. Because there's a direct tie between Superman and bourgeois virtue. Don't you agree? You know Superman, no? So, it's turning Nietzsche on his head now. Because here again, the bourgeoisie co-opts, as it has co-opted everything. Because in the last resort, and I come back to what I told you a long time ago, these are anti-bourgeois, bourgeois revolutions. So, in other words, these are not revolutions of social and economic. I don't believe in that those have any sense of success either. But they are certainly not revolutions of social and economic sorts. They are, in a way, cultural revolutions. And therefore, they are co-opted. And if you think, and perhaps you should think in this thing, if you think of the difference between the Superman you read between these covers and the Superman you knew as a child, Well, anyhow, look at this, and then think of Superman. And if you really have made an analysis, then you know how Nietzsche was tamed. Then you know the Nietzschean idea. Tamed, that is to say, politically, not literarily. Literarily is a quite different thing, but tamed politically. So Superman became, well, how shall I put it, the American Superman. Yeah. And virtue is not denied, but virtue becomes the foundations of virility. To be a man is to be virtuous. Yeah? When your parents told you to be a man, they did not mean you to go off to the red light district of their mountain. So, right? Well, perhaps they did. They were progressive parents. So, I don't know. Anyhow, however that may be, am I making myself clear? So, now I want to end and see whether you have any questions on Nietzsche, as to the taming and come next time. Any questions? I wish you would ask, because it'll be on the exams and so on. And yes. The objective man, he thinks of as the scholarly man, the man of the consensus, who bothers. You are too young to remember all the agitation against objectivity in the late 30s. I think, in the late 60s, I mean. The objective man is the scholarly man, the man of balance, the man of the consensus, the way. And of course, that is, again, making a distinction between the real and apparent world. In the extract I read, you remember, the objective man is described as a film. It's nothing more than a reactor. Nothing more than reacts. He is a villain. He has no willpower. He knows nothing about the chaos of life. That is fundamental, yes? It goes together. Does that make it clear? Yes, it goes together.
Yes. You make some remarks about Russia.
Yes.
Well, he also says here, you know that there may be institutions, there must be a kind of will, distinct or imperative, which is anti-liberal to the point of malice.
Yes, of course.
The will to condition, to authority, to responsibility for centuries to come.
Yeah.
Okay, what's that sort of thing?
Yeah.
When this will is present, something like the Imperium Romanum is founded.
Yeah.
It's
like Russia there, too.
All right. The only power which has endurance, which can wait, which still promise on it.
Yeah, that's right. He has these passages, and there's no doubt he thought of it. But he didn't think of it actually in German terms. If he thought of it, it was in terms of the kind of Europe of Superman, where this sort of non-elite, if I can put it that way, would its willpower would project itself on the political scene. These things are contradictory. There's nothing to be said for it. And these things did lead to, in a way, co-opting Nietzsche for German imperialism. There's no question about that. But here, you see, he said, in the passage I said, he said Europe, and here he says Imperium Romanum, which with Germany had nothing to do whatsoever. So it isn't a German nationalism. That he really condemned. But it is contradictory, yes. No question. There are all these things. Because in a sense, don't you see, Nietzsche himself was flawed. I mean, you can't live as a Nietzsche. There have to be some institutions. But Nietzsche never worked it out. Yes, he has these little passages that there must be institutions, but he never tells us what or what. Then he goes up again on flights. A poet has no obligation to work out a concrete system of government, really. And poets are so attractive because they don't. In other words, Nietzsche, Freud, Marx to a certain extent. If they'd been so clear, there wouldn't be any Marxists or Freudians or Nietzsche, yeah? The trick is not to work it out if you want to become famous that way. Because then it can be adjusted to times, people can read into it what they want, yes? That's much more effective than if you work out a little utopia. That's probably going to be out of date the next week, yeah? And that, of course, becomes the attraction of these poets, the poet as leader, but I told you before. You see what I mean? Yes? No, I don't think there's much evidence for that. He's very contradictory. But what he meant by a philosopher is a kind of poetic philosopher. There's no doubt that he didn't think of himself a philosopher like, let us say, we think of Aristotle as a philosopher. Plato.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Nietzsche's literary taste, because he loves Mark Twain and he likes Dostoevsky, and
yeah,
he had read Crime and Punishment.
Yeah.
He would have seen the whole Napoleonic Superman idea tossed about in a different way.
Dostoevsky was the general craze of Germany or Europe at that point, yes? Yeah? Because Dostoevsky is, in a way, the first existential. Yeah? You read Dostoevsky. His characters are existentialist characters, yes? And above all, this famous one, I forget now her name, very well her name. What is his name? No. What is his name? You know, who killed the pawnbroker? Yeah, Raskolnikov. Became a kind of hero figure for all these people. Because Raskolnikov seemed to them a kind of Nietzschean man. And he is the kind of Nietzschean man who wants every spirit who doesn't care for manners and morals. And Dostoevsky's existentialism was tremendously important in every European country, yeah? Mm-hmm. Not so much Mark Twain, but Dostoevsky had a tremendous importance. Above all, Raskolnikov.
Yeah. I'm a little bit confused about Nietzsche. Nietzsche talks about degeneration.
Yes.
Same with the Greeks, and same with the Greeks decline. And
yes.
Plato was an example of it.
Yeah.
Why was he so worried about degeneration? First of all, you talked about degeneration. What was his place in that whole mythos of degeneration?
Yeah.
Why was he so worried about his society degenerating? If he's got this great feeling about the individual, why is he so concerned with society?
Well, the second question is difficult to answer. I don't know. Because, I'm not interested in society. And by the time Nietzsche wrote, through Max Nordau's book, degeneration had become such a wide concept that nobody avoided. Degeneration is everywhere. And anything bad you want to say, you put it to this framework of Max Nordau. Yes? And in a sense, that goes to what you quoted, and which I didn't say anything about yet, is anti-liberalism. And I'm coming to that when I come to the theme. Nietzsche became the great castigator of liberalism. Yeah? Because, of course, Jenny Tribal, that's liberalism. And so, anti-liberalism means anti-Max Nordau, anti all of this, yes? And what Max Nordau thinks of degeneration, of course, Nietzsche thinks of Superman, it's just the other way. But he uses the word because it became, as it were, general currency. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But he's not using it at all in the same way, then. Using it almost.
Well, you can't, because what is degeneration? Well, it's using it in the same way. It means the same thing. Degeneration is perhaps even a biological decline, yeah? Like Max Nordau. Yeah? But it isn't the same as Max Nordau. It has nothing to do with the morality. Yes? With something quite different. Yeah? Outside the mainstream. But it is just a word, a shorthand. Yeah. The other question I can't answer. It's just a game, one of them. And I wouldn't try to square. Yeah, somebody else.
Yeah. What degree of influence does that have on realism and the
Very great.
And anarchists are the latter part of the...
Oh, very great, yes. Anarchists, he had a very great influence, had not as great influence as Dostoevsky or part of Dostoevsky, but he had a very great influence. No doubt. But his greatest influence was not on anarchy. His greatest influence was on writers, on the literary imagination, if you want to put it that way, on the modern literary and artistic imagination, and his second greatest influence was on politics. To both of those, I would say.
Is there a Thustra of Superman?
Yes. He is supposed for Nietzsche to be the model of the Superman. I never told you that Zarathustra is, of course, a Persian god. I mean, he existed. And Nietzsche simply adopts Zoroaster, yes? Zoroaster, the Persian god, as a framework, yes? Has nothing really to do with the Persian god, that was an emperor. Yes, Zarathustra is to be the model of the Superman. There's no doubt about that, yeah. Are you surprised?
No, it doesn't seem... He seems to have a very defined sense of moral. I expected the Superman to be a more impulsive.
But you see, that's a very good question. I'm glad you raised it. Because he's also Apollonian. Don't forget, the non-impulsive is there. You have to look into yourself with harmony. You have to weigh, yeah? You have to examine yourself, yeah? So, no, and I'm glad you raised that, because that's an important thing. Nietzsche is not all spontaneity, by no means, because you have to examine yourself, you have to know yourself, recognize yourself, as Zarathustra. That is not spontaneity. I'm delighted you raised this, because an important question may have misled you, because you think in the name of Superman of spontaneity, which says something about your culture. Because you believe that as soon as one leaves middle class morals and transforms morals, one has to be spontaneous. But that's far from true in Nietzsche's time. He is really religious in this sense. Examine yourself. So don't forget, what conducts you is the Apollonian dimension. You see what I mean? That's a very good question. I'm glad you raised it. Because there is nothing spontaneous about the Superman. He accepts. There's a great difference by accepting chaos and throwing yourself into it. I mean, you don't have to be spontaneous to go on a roller coaster in a fair, do you? And that's Nietzsche. Life for him is a kind of roller coaster in a fair, yeah, or whatever it is, you know what I mean. And you don't have to be spontaneous to go on the roller coaster. To examine yourself first. Can I take it? What am I? And then, if you're me,
but wouldn't that barbarian be a spontaneous type of person?
Not for him. But he's more spontaneous than the bourgeois. Anybody is. I would avoid the word spontaneity. I would say he has examined himself. He knows himself. He is a better existential person. And existentialism and spontaneity are not the same. Not at all. So avoid the word spontaneity. Because I come to that, perhaps I'll say something next time about it when I come to the literary imagination. But there's nothing spontaneous. Look, you wouldn't say that anything is spontaneous about Jean and the gamekeeper. You see. Or even about what Menalk says in the Moralist. He says, act out your own nature. Menalk doesn't say for Jean to Mikhail, be spontaneous, you know? Whenever you see a potential lover jump, nothing at all like that. He says, follow out your own nature. Something quite different. Quite different, yeah? You see what I mean? It's quite different. Don't confuse that with spontaneity. Well, listen, if you have any other questions, I'll stop at the beginning next time before I do the same.